everyone. I'm Viviana Young, the Environmental Education and Outreach Leader for Umpqua Watersheds through United Communities AmeriCorps and the host of Living Downstream. Umpqua Watersheds values both human and ecological diversity. We celebrate the strengths and perspectives that different people have to offer and believe that organizations, communities, and ecosystems are all more resilient when they embrace the unique gifts various individuals can contribute. We acknowledge that the land upon which Umpqua Watersheds is located was formerly occupied and tended by various indigenous groups, including Cow Creek Umpqua, Coquille, Molalla, and others. Their history is intertwined with this place, and we seek to continue to practice stewardship and reciprocity towards the natural environment, which Indigenous people did for thousands of years prior to European settlement. Today we have with us Caitlin Scheffler and Billy Crawford with Wildlife Images Rehabilitation and Education Center. Would you two like to introduce yourselves and tell us a bit about Wildlife Images?
Sure. Hi, I'm Billy Crawford, and I'm a member of the Board of Directors, but more importantly for this, I'm a volunteer with our Birds of Prey in our clinical rehabilitation.
And I'm Caitlin Scheffler, and I am the Interpretive Coordinator here at Wildlife Images.
Great to hear from both of you. So when was Wildlife Images founded, and how was it founded?
So Wildlife Images was opened 40 years ago as a nonprofit rehabilitation facility that takes in over 1,200 animals every year at no cost to the general public. We're also an educational facility with over 50 ambassador animals that help us teach people about the importance of our mission, saving wildlife.
Amazing. And how did you get involved?
So I came from another zoo in San Diego and moved here, started here as a tour guide. And eventually just kind of fell into a couple of other roles that include running our social media accounts and some event planning and the outreach coordination here.
Mine wasn't quite so direct. We put an owl box up in our backyard and attracted a screech owl. And we had her for a couple of years. And then we found her in our backyard. She had crashed into a window. So we didn't know what to do. So we contacted a local wildlife rehabber and got her rehabbed and brought her back. And then she ended up having babies after the rehab. And at that point, we knew this was cool. This is what we're going to do.
And that brings us into our next topic of how do you generally find or get the animals that need to be rehabilitated?
Yes, generally, members of the public will bring them in to us. They will find them. They'll call. They'll ask if they need to be brought in. Sometimes they do. Sometimes they don't. Then if they're able to get them contained, then they'll bring them into us. We also work with law enforcement agencies. People will call 911 if they'll see an eagle down or something. And oftentimes the sheriff's deputy or the police officers will bring them in. And sometimes if we're available, we will go out and do a pickup if we can.
We do need someone out there, you know, rehabilitating these wild animals. And it doesn't seem like there's a lot of different organizations that do that.
Right.
So there is sometimes a problem with these rehabilitation situations in which if handlers are too close and friendly with the animals, they can become almost tamed, not quite tamed, but you get the idea.
There are two words. One is imprinting and the other is habituating. So if an animal is imprinted, that will usually happen with baby animals, baby raptors particularly. Is if they look up and you're the first thing they see when they're at that moment, they will think that you are their parent. And then they won't grow up to be a wild animal. The other is habituation. If an animal gets used to us bringing it food and gets used to us being around, it may not be releasable. So we prevent that by several ways. One, the public does not have access to our clinical patients. So we really limit their human contact. When we're with the animals, we don't talk. We're very quiet. We don't want them to get used to our voices. If they do start to show signs of habituation, we will, actually we call it hazing. So we'll spray water or make noise or something so they associate us with things that are not pleasant and want to fly away. With baby animals, when we go in to feed them, we will often dress up in camouflage or we have a hat that makes us look like a tree. So add on, and then we'll never feed them with our hands. We'll always feed with tweezers because we don't want them to associate our fingers with food.
And so why would you say it's important to make sure that these animals don't habituate or imprint?
Because if they habituate or imprint, they won't be releasable. And that's when we have to make the horrible worst decision of humane euthanasia. If the animal cannot survive in the wild, we can't release it. And we can't always keep all of them. Occasionally, there'll be an animal that will have a temperament to become an ambassador animal. Sometimes because of their injury, if it's a head injury, they might make an ambassador animal, but that is kind of rare. But as I said, it's important that they don't think good things of humans because we want them to avoid us because that will increase their odds of success in the wild.
So you said ambassador. Could you explain what those are and maybe what they do?
So an ambassador animal is an animal specifically set out to meet the public in order to help educate and facilitate those good emotional reactions that people need to be able to form positive opinions for wildlife so that we can help encourage people to become knowledgeable about those animals and also to help save them and help us save them, which is our overall mission, is to save wildlife.
Right. And these are animals that cannot be released back into the wild. Something has happened to them. They've either been imprinted, habituated, or an injury that makes them unreleasable.
And some of them are actually able to help us save wildlife. There's a couple of our animals that we utilize as foster parents. So even though they can't go back out into the wild, they might help us raise baby animals mm-hmm. so that they don't become imprinted, so they don't become used to people. And it's so much easier to release them back out into the wild when they've already met their own species and that foster parent is able to teach them how to be good adult birds.
And do you use all sorts of animals as ambassador animals or mostly just birds or mammals? Or do you have a specific kind you tend to use?
Mostly with birds. We tend to do it with small mammals if they are community dwellers. Some of them, if they live in isolation, then they don't need a foster parent. They're going to develop their skills innately. But yeah, we recently had a great horned owl that we used our ambassador great horned owl as a foster parent. And while our great horned owl does lay eggs periodically, we found out that she's not really into being a mom. So she tolerated the baby, but she didn't really adopt it that well. But still, it was better for the baby to grow up with another great horned owl.
And we do have other ambassador animals that are mammals as well. So generally we have a few reptiles, mostly mm-hmm. mammals and birds though.
All right. So the title of your place is Rehabilitation Education Center. We can go into education a little bit more. I know that those ambassador animals are used for education in some cases, but you also offer classes and camps. Would you like to discuss those sorts of programs?
Sure. Our education program is constantly expanding and we're really excited to offer some more new and updated things this year. We have a lecture series where people come and especially adults are able to get the opportunity that maybe they won't because we're not going to bring an adult to say a camp, but it does provide them with that really interesting opportunity to learn kind of in the similar way that they would at a camp. We do have our camps. So we offer them all summer long, a couple in the winter and the fall as well. It's called Camp Eek. It's really awesome. If you want to sign up your kiddos, please go to our website and feel free to do so at wildlifeimages.org. We're about to have a spring break one coming up soon. We also offer field trips for school groups to come out where we'll give them a tour of the park and teach them about our animals and why it's important to save them. We have tours, outreach programs, keeper talks, all kinds of things. It is our mission to educate people in a way that will help us save wildlife.
Amazing. Your park is here in the Pacific Northwest. Is that correct?
That is correct. In Grants Pass, Oregon.
All right. So the Pacific Northwest does have some unique perspectives on climate change. And I know that you guys have looked into climate change quite a bit and its effect specifically on wildlife. Could you describe a little bit about historical climate change cycles and how more recent changes might be different from those historical cycles?
Sure. You know, historically, going back several thousands of years, the climate is always changing. There have been times when there were glaciers as far south as Kansas. That definitely affects the climate. There was a time when there was a 2-mile-thick glacier in Michigan. When it receded, it formed the Great Lakes. So we've always had climate change. What's different today is the speed of climate change. When it's slow, animals have a chance to adapt and their food supplies have a chance to adapt. When it's fast, they can't always evolve and adapt at a pace that can make them remain successful. So as climate warms, some animals can go further north. If the animal is already in the north, then they may not have any place to go. If the climate changes and changes the food supply, they may be able to move with their food supply. They may not be able to move with the food supply. Said some animals that are specialists that can only live in one area or only eat one thing, are in danger of becoming extinct. Animals that are generalist, that can live in multiple areas and have a wide variety of food sources, will often have a better chance of survival.
Right. It's interesting that you mentioned those migration events. So it's my understanding that a lot of our native wildlife might be moving to migrate to more accommodating temperatures. So we're losing a lot of our biodiversity. Would you agree with that?
I would agree with that. And something that happened last summer is we went through this horrible heat wave where we were in excess of 110 degrees. And it happened right when raptors, particularly Cooper's hawks, had their nestlings. And when it gets that hot, the nestlings go a little crazy and they jump out of the nest too early. So we were inundated with baby Cooper's hawks. In fact, I personally re-nested about three groups just because the heat made them jump out of the nest too early, which meant that they were going to be vulnerable to predators and probably not survive.
And there are so many birds and other animals that people don't know of that are key species in our ecosystem, like those hawks that you describe. I'm sure that they play more of a role than people might give them credit for. So it is really affecting us that they're dying off like that. They do things behind the scenes, like I'm assuming they're predators.
Yeah, rodent control.
Rodent control is a big one. Yes. And then another thing that's killing animals, not just birds, but more land-based animals, is our water is drying up because of this changing climate. Animals can't drink at smaller streams that are drying up. Our fish are dying off. Can you describe a little bit about how this decrease in water is affecting our ecosystem?
Absolutely. So two things come to mind. One, with the water being warmer, it's not good for salmon runs. Salmon need cold water. A healthy ecosystem has a lot of salmon because a lot of animals feed on salmon. So at a place called the Rogue River Preserve, run by the Southern Oregon Land Conservancy, there's a river that goes through, and we'll find that the bears go down to eat the salmon. Then the bears come up and fertilize all the other areas, which brings up more native plants. Then the birds come in, eat the native plants, carry the seeds, and spread those. So just the fact that the water gets warmer and affects the salmon runs has a cascading effect for multiple species. We also noticed last year, due to the drought in the Klamath National Wildlife Refuge, is that migration patterns for birds going from north to south changed dramatically because of the lack of water.
Right. And it also affects sediment. If we don't have water for long enough, plants die off. And that doesn't hold the rocks and the minerals in the same way that it used to historically. And we can get these almost deserts. I know that in some places in the world, this is a serious issue because it's hard for the environment to recover from these deserts.
Yes.
And then in addition to lack of water, we get increased fires. What kind of problems do fires bring to our environment?
So fires will also make wildlife migrate. And I live in Ashland, Oregon, and we had some fires come through a couple of years ago that were pretty severe. And we noticed we were finding animals in urban areas that we normally wouldn't because the fires had forced them out. Birds can fly away. Other animals will run away. Now, many animals thrive in a little bit of fire, control fire. There are a couple of woodpeckers. There's a black-backed woodpecker that only you'll find them only in burned out forests, but that's kind of the minority. So yeah, it does affect their habitat. It affects their food supplies, and it does decrease the areas where they can live.
And it also affects wildlife images as a whole as well. We do have, you know, all of these animals that live here and rely on us for their safety and support. And so we always have one eye on the horizon and be very cognizant of what's going on around us, because those animals, we would have to find a way to get them out. And some of the animals are coming into us because of the fires, and we can't protect them if there's a fire, say, right here. So we do have air quality measuring capability right on site so that we can make sure that our animals are staying as healthy as they possibly can be. If you come during fire season, it's a likelihood you'll see sheets up in front of our bird aviaries just to help add that extra layer of protection. We've all been wearing masks for the last 2 years, so we all know what that can do and what that's about. And it's very, very similar in its effect. So yeah, it really does affect not only wildlife, but also the people who are trying to save it.
Yeah, we also have evacuation plans if we are threatened by fire. And think about evacuating a zoo with mountain lions and bears and patients and wolves. It's involved.
Right. And earlier you mentioned how fires can drive animals that have not been in urban areas into urban areas. And that can look like raccoons or possums or even larger animals like mountain lions. Would you say that these fires and climate change in general are causing some coexistence issues between humans and more dangerous wildlife?
I'll say yes, the fires, but also habitat loss is more prevalent for that area.
And those big animals like say a cougar, they're not looking to hang around and live in your backyard. Mostly they would probably be passing through looking for a safe place to go from the fires. So it's not like they want to stay. They're not urbanized. Right. They don't want to be there, but they're just looking for a place to go. So being careful about helping support and protect native habitat is incredibly important.
And then some animals will come in and realize that we're a great source of food because we generate a lot of trash.
Right. That's how we get raccoons and some black bears, I believe, in this area, interested in trash.
Yeah, I think the black bears in Ashland know the trash schedule.
Yes. So some rivers and streams and other bodies of water have increased temperatures and how that's affecting the salmon. But we also have increased temperatures of our oceans. So along our coastline, some marine life is suffering. Do you know anything about that?
Yeah. So over the past 50, 100 years, the ocean temperature has risen. That is something that can be and has been measured by scientists. There are scientists who go out every day and they'll take a surface temperature and they'll take a bottom temperature. And then over the past 100 years, they've been doing this almost every single day. And they've been able to accurately track the warming temperature, which is almost, I believe, 2 degrees Celsius at this point. And unfortunately, it causes a lot of issues, not just because of the ocean warming, but it also causes ocean acidification, which is detrimental because there's a lot of soft-bodied animals and invertebrates that just can't tolerate that, which affects directly the food web, not just for, say, the animals in the ocean, but also, we're all connected. So it does end up affecting us on land as well.
So I think that some listeners might not know much about ocean acidification. Could you define it or explain it a little?
Yeah. So if you imagine maybe if you put an eggshell in a glass of vinegar, you will slowly start to see bubbles. And that's because the eggshell is made of a substance that will dissolve as the acidity in the water rises. And so a lot of marine life have similar shells or similar body parts that will also dissolve with higher acidic ocean temperatures and higher acidity in the oceans. So they are affected and it can affect like whether or not they can have young or whether or not their eggs survive in the ocean. So it sounds like a really complicated process, and it is, but it is really detrimental to them and their health.
So some of these animals that you're talking about, like little shellfish and such, some people might have a hard time seeing why it's so important to save and preserve our native wildlife, including such small creatures like that. Could you explain a little bit about why it is so important to save these species, even if we don't directly see what they might do for us?
So not only is all life connected through the food web, but also all life deserves a chance to survive. Wildlife Images, our sole mission is saving wildlife, whether it's a small little, mouse or rat that we get brought in, maybe it's an egg that we need to incubate and hatch and then raise that baby so that it can be released into the wild, or it could be an otter or a bobcat. We released both of those last year that are maybe more, people like to see those and care about those a lot more because they're more soft and squishy. But I think we really need to change our mindset a little bit towards being more open to finding things like those little mice, like those crustaceans, fascinating and important just because they exist, regardless of whether or not they do us any good.
Right. And they affect each other a lot more deeply than it seems on the surface. They can create domino effects. If a specific species is lost, that can change vegetation. It can change the rocks and minerals of a landscape. It can change how other animals interact with each other and the ecosystem. Do you have any examples or Does anything come to mind about some of these domino effects that might happen when a species is lost?
One that I thought of immediately that affects humans is in a number of cities in India, the vultures were being killed, basically. And without the vultures to come in and clean up all of the dead animals, that showed a rise in wild dog packs. So parts of India were overrun with wild dogs, which increased the number of dog bites for people, which increased the number of rabies cases that were seen in India. So yeah, there was a direct correlation from poisoning vultures because somebody thought they were gross or they were pointing at poachers that ultimately ended up in a disease vector coming into humans.
And maybe a more local example might be like our gray wolf population.
Yes.
Do you want to talk about that a little bit, Billy?
Okay.
So gray wolves are incredibly important. They're apex predators in their native ecosystems. There's a lot of human conflict with gray wolves, but I think that it is important that we recognize that they are important in their ecosystems because they are an apex predator, but they're also a keystone species. So if you imagine an archway, at the tippy top of that archway is one stone that kind of holds it all together. And that is what the gray wolf does to its native ecosystem. When gray wolves are absent from an ecosystem, the prey items that they might eat will actually become overpopulated. The sick, the old, and the very young are allowed to continue, and disease can spread through a population, and there's not enough resources to go around for a population. And unfortunately, they'll overgraze in a particular area, and these overgrazing might be usually near a water source. So if you imagine maybe they're near a river, it can cause all of the plant life to become decimated in that area, which can also cause erosion. And the river might become wider or more shallow and also might not be as clean as it was before, which directly affects almost every other animal in the ecosystem because we all need food, water, and shelter. So.
Right. All you have to do is Google the effect of wolves for Yellowstone National Park, and you'll get some great documentaries about how wolves change the ecosystem for the better.
How many challenges do these gray wolves face? What are the biggest challenges that we can directly see that are hurting these gray wolves?
My opinion is just going to be what people think of them. If people are threatened by them, ranchers sometimes are not pro-wolf. So truly, I think it's human contact and human interaction is their greatest challenge.
And where can people learn more about that topic and everything we've discussed and even further? Where can people learn more?
They can come visit us. We actually have 4 gray wolf dogs right here at Wildlife Images. We give keeper talks every day and behind the scenes tours and have educational programs aimed at teaching people about these wonderful animals and why they deserve to be protected and saved.
And how can people contact you virtually, like from afar?
Yeah, so if you are virtual and you're not able to come visit us in person, we have a Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter account, all Wildlife Images. And then we are Wildlife Images Education and Rehabilitation Facility. You can look us up. Our email is savingwildlife.org. If you have any questions, please feel free to reach out. And our website address is wildlifeimages.org, where you can get essentially links to all of the things I just said.
And what can people do to help? Is there any way to donate or volunteer or anything like that?
Oh, yes. So there are multiple ways to donate. So if you go to our webpage, you'll find donate buttons. And also, even though we are heavily regulated by governmental authorities, the Department of Fish and Wildlife, U.S. Department of Fish and Wildlife, we don't receive any outside funding. So we are completely donation-based. But yes, donations, becoming a regular monthly donor, becoming a member of Wildlife Images, and then you get to be in a special club with special events and special member releases. People who really get into it can be in our legacy society where we become part of your estate, and also to come and volunteer with us. We have all kinds of jobs, and it's not just working with animals. We have folks who come and volunteer for landscaping and make our campus beautiful. We have folks who come in and do food preparation for our animals. They're the chefs. We have folks who help us with database management. We have folks who work with birds. We have folks who work with mammals, with reptiles. So there are all kinds of opportunities.
Amazing. And what can people do from their home or their own neighborhood or local ecosystem? What can people do to reduce their carbon footprint, for example, or just help the environment in general?
Yeah, so we are all about wildlife in your backyard because there's so much that each and every one of us can do. And you don't have to do it all. I want to start with that. If we all do a little bit, it means a lot for wildlife. So something as simple as planting native, that's a huge one. You're already jump-starting that native ecosystem from the bottom up. If you start by planting native plants in your garden, you can get a bat box or an owl box. You could get a birdhouse or a hummingbird feeder. It doesn't have to be big, but if everyone does a little bit, we all kind of work together and create this wonderful, like, wildlife saving community.
Well, thank you so much for appearing on the show. It's been lovely having you, and you have a lot of great ideas. And again, just thank you for what you do at Wildlife Images. It really means a lot for the environment and the people who share this world with nature.
Thank you.
Thank you. And thanks for asking us to do this. This is always... We're obviously passionate about this stuff. I mean, I donate 2 days a week, some financial resources, and I'm just an old retired guy, but obviously a wildlife geek. So this kind of stuff is important to us, and getting the word out is how we're going to basically just keep this thing going.
We want to make our passion your passion.
I'm also passionate about the environment. So it's great to have people like you on the show to talk about these things, because I didn't even know about Wildlife Images before I heard from you guys, honestly. It is good to hear that there are places out there that do this sort of thing, that there are other nature geeks. And now for some brief announcements. Do you want to reconnect to your community? Do you want to access our local trails more often? Do you just need some sunshine? Good! This February 26th at 10 a.m., head to the Roseburg Duck Pond by Fred Meyer for a Trails Day event. Help us keep the Thrive Umpqua Blue Zones Project Umpqua Trail clean and welcoming to our community. Enjoy good company and a brisk walk as well. All are welcome to join. Thrive Umpqua and United Communities AmeriCorps also invite you to the St. Patrick's Pedal and Pet event. Bike or walk with us on March 12th at 10 a.m. Bring your gear to the half shell and wear green. This family-friendly event encourages natural movement and a greener, healthier mode of transport. We hope that by sharing this ride together, we can make underutilized routes become more active as the weather warms. It's fun for everyone, with a raffle opportunity after the route is completed. Visit Thrive Umpqua's Facebook event page to sign up and for more information. If you love to read and would like to discuss environmental topics with fellow bookworms, try Turning Over a New Leaf Book Club. Turning Over a New Leaf Book Club meets over Zoom every other month and will next meet on Saturday, March 26th. The book to be discussed will be Waste, One Woman's Fight Against America's Dirty Secret by Catherine Coleman Flowers. All sessions take place virtually at 5 p.m. on their date. For more information, please email Umpqua Watershed's Director of Education and Outreach, Ryan Kincaid. Her email is ryan@umpquawatersheds.org. Or, if you'd like to share your environmental knowledge with the community by being interviewed for an episode of Living Downstream, email me at viviana@umpquawatersheds.org. That's viviana@umpquawatersheds.org. So for the second half of today's episode, we have David James, a professor of entomology at Washington State University. Hello, Mr. James. Would you like to tell us what you do?
Yes, I'm, as you say, a professor at Washington State University in the Department of Entomology, and I'm interested in insect conservation and also pest management. I do a lot of work with viticulture and biological control of pests, but butterflies are my main interest as an entomologist.
So I understand that you've been doing that for most of your life, been a lepidopterist for most of your life. What first sparked your interest in butterflies and moths?
Well, I was actually 8 years old, which is a long time ago now. I was born in England, as you can tell by my accent. But yeah, I was 8 years old and I saw caterpillars in the garden, and I reared them into these brightly coloured moths. And I was hooked from then on. And I went to university knowing I wanted to be involved in insects, with insects in some way. And that's how my career started. So yes, I'm a lifelong entomologist. And after the moths came the butterflies, of course. And yeah, it's been my life.
On the topic of butterflies and moths, what are some prominent species that are around us in our everyday lives that we might be able to identify? And do you have any tips for identifying those species?
Sure. Well, you know, the Pacific Northwest is a pretty rich place for butterflies. There's about 160 species. Not all of them occur in Southern Oregon, of course, but a lot of them do. And so we're pretty lucky. There's a couple of butterflies that are very familiar in the Pacific Northwest and Southern Oregon. One of these is a Western tiger swallowtail, a large yellow butterfly that is often seen during the summer flying. And this, you know, is often seen in urban areas. So many people see this butterfly. Another butterfly that we often see more so in the past than more recently is the monarch butterfly. Most people would have heard about the decline in monarch butterflies in recent years. But, you know, about 5 years ago, we'd see them regularly every summer in Southern Oregon and throughout the Pacific Northwest. And hopefully in the future, we will see them again because their numbers have come up again this year. So those two butterflies are the ones that most people see because they fly far and wide, whereas a lot of butterflies tend to stay in their habitats, you know, in small areas.
So in general, how can the layman tell the difference between a butterfly and a moth?
Well, that's quite difficult. It's more difficult than it sounds, actually, because there are some differences, but no, none of the differences are exclusive. There's, you know, you can't say that all butterflies fly by day because some moths fly by day. And, you know, many moths are just as colourful as butterflies. So you have to look more closely at them. And probably the most consistent difference is the antennae. The antennae of butterflies has a club at its end, whereas many moth antennae are either just filaments or they're feathery. So that's the difference that is the most reliable. But even that has some exceptions.
So is there any way to tell maybe in their larval state, like when they're caterpillars, or is it basically impossible to tell when they're that young?
Yes, it is basically impossible. And the caterpillar stage, there's some wonderful looking caterpillars that turn out to be moths, and there's some boring looking caterpillars that turn out to be butterflies. So there's huge diversity, and really you cannot tell from a caterpillar whether it's going to be a moth or a butterfly.
Although they are both very pretty, moths or butterflies, I'm sure that they have a bigger role to play in our ecosystem. Can you tell us a little bit about what they do for our local environment and environments in general?
Yes, they're both very important parts of the ecosystem. I mean, primarily as food for other organisms. They're pretty low down on the tree of life, that is, and they form the food of birds and other insects and small animals. So they're a very important part of the food web. They're also important as pollinators, and this is something that the people tend to forget. When we think of pollinators, we think of bees and particularly honeybees, but butterflies and moths are also quite important pollinators as well. And so, you know, just those two things make them very important in any ecosystem.
So I understand now that they are very important, but I'm also under the impression that there are challenges that our native butterflies and moths are facing. What are those challenges?
Yes, they are facing a lot of challenges. Probably the primary challenge is loss of habitat through agriculture and urban development, taking away habitat. We in this part of the world, in Pacific Northwest, are not as challenged by this perhaps as more intensively urbanized areas like in Europe and United Kingdom. But, you know, we still have our challenges with urban sprawl and agriculture, particularly agriculture, broad acre agriculture. And so that is the primary reason of insect decline, we think, is the loss of habitat. There are other things too, like climate change and pesticides, but it's the habitat loss that is the most important.
So in addition to things like climate change and habitat loss, are they facing any challenges from invasive species?
In some instances, perhaps, but in the wide scheme of things, then that is not as important, nowhere near as important as habitat loss and climate change and even pesticide usage. Those probably are the three big things that are causing and having an impact on insect populations generally, butterfly populations specifically. Unfortunately, there's not good long-term data on these things, and a lot of it is anecdotal. There are some exceptions, and the monarch butterfly is one of those where we have had a long-term recording of data on overwintering populations in California. So we know that the population has declined, but for many butterflies, you know, some butterflies that we hardly know about, you know, we know very little about their biology and ecology. We have no information really on how they're faring in this time, you know, how their populations are, you know, declining or increasing. So there's a lot of information that's lacking on what is actually happening with a lot of our butterflies.
So now that we've covered some basics about butterflies, I understand that you co-authored a book. Could you tell us a little bit about it, what it's about maybe?
Yeah, so this was a book that Dave Nunnally and I published 10 years ago now, but it's a work on the life histories of Pacific Northwest butterflies. Essentially, we, you know, I just made the point that we know very little about the butterflies, and that was brought home to us because we tried to rear every single species of butterfly in the Pacific Northwest, which was a challenge in itself. But through doing that, you know, rearing them from egg through all the caterpillar stages, you know, caterpillars shed their skins and molt 3 or 4 or 5 times, the chrysalis stage and the adult stage, and photographing them and learning about them, we discovered there was a lot of questions about them, about their life histories, that we couldn't answer. So the book actually raised a lot more questions than provided answers. But the book did provide photographs of all these stages. And we found that, you know, even commonly known butterflies as adults, you know, flying down the street, some of these butterflies have not really been photographed as caterpillars and immature stages. So, you know, what we did was quite unique just for this geographical area, the Pacific Northwest. And so, you know, throughout the world, there's many species that we wouldn't even be able to recognize the caterpillars because they've rarely been seen, let alone photographed. And moths even more so, because there's far more species of moths than there are species of butterflies.
What's the title of the book?
Sure. The title of the book is Life Histories of Cascadia Butterflies. And you can get it from Amazon and all good bookstores, I think. And as I say, it's a pretty unique study of the life history of all our butterflies. So if you're interested in, you know, seeing what a tiger swallowtail looks like as a caterpillar, then this is the book.
Well, thank you for telling us about that. So what kind of research are you currently involved in? What kind of activities? I understand that you're doing some research on Western monarchs.
Yes, the Western monarch has been a focus for the last decade now. We did not know prior to 10 years ago exactly what our monarchs did during the autumn, where they migrated to. I mean, everybody's heard about the famous migration of monarch butterflies in the eastern US flying to Mexico. We suspected our Pacific Northwest monarchs flew to California for the winter, but we weren't entirely sure. We thought that maybe some of them flew to Mexico. So we began a program of tagging, which means, you know, marking the butterflies with a small tag that contains information. This is old-fashioned tags. They're not electronic tags, unfortunately, but you can read an email address on the tag and a serial number. So we've done this program, this research, for about a decade now. And from all that data that we've collected over the years, we now know that most of the butterflies from Pacific Northwest go to California for overwintering. All the monarch butterflies in Southern Oregon go to California. Some of the butterflies in Washington, some of the monarchs in Washington, actually head towards Arizona. We haven't actually had any recoveries from further than Utah yet, but they're definitely heading in a different direction. And we suspect that some Washington butterflies and also some Idaho butterflies head to Mexico for overwintering. So that's been a big part of my research over the last decade. But I'm also involved, as I said, with viticulture, and I managed to get butterflies into vineyards as well by discovering that the host plant of monarch butterflies, which is milkweed, as most people know, is also a very important plant for attracting beneficial insects. And by that, I mean predators and parasitoids of pest insects that affect grapevines. And it's not only milkweed, there's some other native plants too that we've found can be utilized in vineyards, if not in the rows, then around the vineyard nearby, to be grown, and they can encourage or enhance biological control of pests and also provide a resource for butterflies. So we call in this project Beauty with Benefits because, you know, we're beautifying the vineyard with native plants that are providing resources for native butterflies and other insects too, pollinators generally, But they're also helping in the biological control of pests in vineyards. So this is something we've been doing in Washington and also in Oregon. There's a few viticulturists in Oregon that are adopting the same kind of strategy. So those are the two main areas I've been researching recently.
So I'm kind of wondering, the data about these migration patterns, what does that data go towards? What does it contribute to?
Well, it gives us a better understanding of what the monarchs are doing. I mean, as I said, we've been very concerned about the decline in monarch populations in the West for some time now. And to try and rectify that, to try and help them, to provide milkweed, for example, provide habitat for them, because, as I mentioned, habitat loss is probably the key reason for the decline of the monarch as well as other butterflies. I mean, if we know the migration route of the butterflies and where they're going, then we can make an attempt to ensure that resources that butterflies need during migration, i.e. nectar, are available. So by better understanding the butterflies, you know, understanding the migratory behavior, overwintering behavior, summer behavior, knowing more about them allows us to be better armed, if you like, to actually do something to help them.
And that goes right into our next topic, which is sustainable pest management, which is another topic that you've been looking into recently, as I understand. Are there any coexistence problems between humans and moths or butterflies, and how might we approach those issues?
No, I really think we can coexist very well. And the Beauty of Benefits project is a good example of that, I think. You know, we can beautify vineyards to make them aesthetically more pleasing and also enhance, you know, the agriculture. We're enhancing biological control, which means utilizing native predators and parasitoids to help control pests of grapevines. And that means using less chemicals, because if we don't have biological control, we have chemical control, which means pesticides and, you know, chemicals on grapes is not something anybody wants to see. I mean, that's what used to happen, but we're now in a position to be able to change that. And butterflies and pollinators and insects can be part of that shift in thinking. You know, ultimately, we could have vineyards as mini nature reserves. There's work being done to actually make this become a reality in New Zealand and in Europe. I'm sure we can do it here. And you know, what I've described, we're all already on the way to being able to do that. So yeah, we're, you know, moths and butterflies are creatures that we can live with. I mean, everybody loves butterflies. I mean, this is something else that's always struck me throughout my career, is that no matter who the person is you're talking to, they invariably love butterflies, whether it be a small child or, you know, anybody. Anybody and everybody loves butterflies.
So like you said, everyone does love butterflies. And I think another problem, though, is that moths don't have the same general love as butterflies do, even though they have many similarities. For example, I remember hearing as a child that I shouldn't allow moths in the house because of their issues with eating our clothes. I think that's a fairly common and popular rumor as well. Do you have anything to say about that?
Yes, for sure. And you're exactly right. Moths do have a bad PR problem just because of the clothes moth situation that you're referring to. And that is caused by one species of a tiny species of moth that is known commonly as the clothes moth. And because of that one species, the whole moth kingdom, you know, thousands of different species has suffered because of that PR. So yes, I mean, the moths, all the moths you see in day-to-day life that are attracted to lights at night, and if they come in the house, they are not going to cause you concern. There's just this one species that actually is not that common anymore, because people have done such a good job at keeping them out of their houses, I think. You know, it's a very small moth too. It's visible, but barely. So it's tiny, and it's the larvae of the moth that actually feed on garments, you know, material. But it, as I say, it's quite rare. So moths generally do a lot of good outside in the garden. They're pollinators, as I said. They're also food for birds. I mean, without moths, the bird population would drastically decline. Moths are a major source of food for birds, whether it be the caterpillars or the adult moths. So yeah, moths do have bad PR, but we should strive to make them better understood by the general public.
So you mentioned that we have actually done a pretty successful job at keeping them out of our homes, and that's reduced the excessive population. What are some other ways that the average gardener or homeowner can handle that kind of pest management in sustainable and environmentally friendly ways?
Yeah, well, you know, in the garden, I really advocate an organic approach. You know, there is a major problem with using pesticides in gardens, both in terms of human health and safety, but also in killing the wrong things. And unfortunately, some of the insecticides we have available today, a lot of these chemicals may be quite safe to people, which is why they're popular, but they're also have sublethal effects for other insects, or lethal effects. They're not, what I'm trying to say is that they're not just killing the pests that we want to kill. They're also having an impact on the pests we don't want to kill, like the butterflies and the bees and all the good things. So if it is at all possible, then a non-chemical approach to management of pests in the garden is much better in the long run. And for most pest species, you know, an organic approach can be found and can be utilized. You know, and sometimes the problems we have in gardens are not really that big. It depends what it is, I guess. But, you know, it's not, a lot of them are not so bad that you need to apply chemicals for. For example, we talked about moths and butterflies. I mean, there is actually one butterfly, the cabbage white butterfly, that, as its name suggests, will feed on cabbages if you're growing cabbages. But the populations tend to be fairly low. And so maybe one or two cabbages will be attacked. And you know, so really just grow an extra cabbage or two for the butterfly. So things like that can often be adopted, and you can get round not having to spray for something like cabbage white butterflies. So I think that's the message there, is to try and avoid chemicals if you possibly can.
Would you have similar advice for larger corporations like big agriculture, that sort of thing?
Yes, certainly. And a lot of corporations in agriculture and big concerns, farms, are actually going in that direction. There's less chemical use now in agriculture than there was, say, a decade or two decades ago. And a lot of the chemicals being used now are far less impactful in terms of direct toxicity than they were two decades ago. And I mean, they're more selective too. So they're more targeted towards the pest and not collateral damage, not killing the things we don't want to kill. I mean, you couldn't have said that 20 years ago, because most of the pesticides that were used would kill everything. So fortunately, that's not the case anymore. And the idea of integrated pest management, which means, you know, incorporating biological control too, is what most big corporations in agriculture are striving for now. So it's, you know, it takes time, and it is taking time to adopt fully, but bit by bit, we are getting there. And, you know, in another decade or so, we'll be in an even better position than we are now. But, you know, in industries like viticulture, which I've talked about already, you can look back, you know, 20 years and see huge differences in terms of pesticide application and the use of biological control, far more, you know, improved now than it was 20 years ago. So things are changing, and that's a good thing for all of us, of course.
So do you know of any legislation that protects our local fragile populations of butterflies or moths from maybe big agriculture or anything? Do we have any protections for these species?
Not really. I mean, in some localized situations, there may be. You know, it may surprise you to know that, you know, the overwintering populations of monarch butterflies in California are not protected on public land, on private land, or whatever land. They're not protected. I mean, there's efforts now underway to change that, to have more protections in place. And so it can be done on a state level, and maybe even on a local level, but it generally has not been done when you're looking at ecosystems or habitats. I mean, you know, so there are habitats that are known to support rare butterflies, for example. And the only way to protect them in most instances is to get the butterflies declared listed as an endangered or threatened species. And that has happened for some insects and some butterfly species. There's some, you know, in Oregon, in fact, in Northern Oregon, there's a couple of species that are protected by federal legislation. But these are the exception rather than the rule. And there are a lot more butterflies that are in habitats that are threatened, that are not protected. But you know, a lot of it goes back to not knowing enough about how these butterflies are doing. There's probably a lot of butterflies that need protection, yet we don't even know that they need protection.
Is there anything that listeners, for example, to this radio show can do either to make that legislation or to advocate for the butterfly populations? Is there anything that people can do either personally or legally to help?
Yeah, I mean, advocacy always helps. I mean, I advise and suggest everybody advocate for populations of threatened butterflies. And a lot of that's happening right now, of course, with the monarch butterfly. We have the Western Monarch Advocates, which is an organization that grew out from interest in Oregon and Pacific Northwest about the state of our Western Monarch population. And that's, you know, it's a young organization, but it's already paying dividends and getting the message across to people that we need to look after these species and to fight for them. And there are things we can do, even on a local level. You know, even if you have a backyard, you can grow the right plants that will encourage butterflies to nectar and in some cases to actually lay their eggs and develop. And milkweed and monarch butterflies are the obvious pairing that a lot of people already do. You know, throughout Oregon, there are many people that grow milkweed specifically to attract monarch butterflies and to support their populations, which is great. But we could do that for other butterfly species too, if people knew more about them, of course. So, you know, even if you just have your own backyard, you can make an impact and you can grow butterfly-friendly nectar plants. You know, not all flowering plants are attractive to butterflies. You can, you know, easily look up what kind of plants are attractive to butterflies and grow those plants. And butterfly attractive plants will also generally attract other pollinators as well. So pollinator friendly plants is what you should be looking for. So there are things that everybody can do to help, you know, populations of insects.
And I imagine just doing something as simple as trying to reduce your carbon footprint also helps the grander scheme, including the protection of our local insects and insects around the world.
Yes, sure. I mean, the insects around the world generally are in decline. There's been a lot of media stories about this in the past decade, and it is a real thing that's happening for many causes. I mean, we talked at the beginning about habitat, and habitat is probably the number one thing, but climate change, you know, is a big issue. It is changing populations of insects throughout the world. You know, when climate's warm, then butterflies or other insects either adapt and survive, or they die, or they move elsewhere. You know, there's like three options they have. And unfortunately, some of the more resident species, the specialist species that are confined to particular habitats, for example, you know, there's some butterflies in the Pacific Northwest that only live at tops of mountains. You know, if it warms at the top of the mountain, where do they go? There's nowhere for them to go. So you know, reducing our carbon footprint and trying to get put the brakes on warming of the climate would certainly be something that would be good for, you know, preserving insect populations.
So do you know of any places to find more information about this topic? Where can people go to learn more about butterflies and moths and that sort of topic in general?
There's many sources. The major one in Pacific Northwest is the Xerces Society for Insect Conservation. That would be a good stop-off point to find other sources as well from them. They have a lot of material about conservation, obviously, butterflies, but also other insects too. And we mustn't forget, you know, the charismatic species like butterflies get all the attention, but a lot of the non-charismatic species are also suffering too. And the Xerces Society does, you know, feature them and help them as well. So that would be the first place to go to, I think, and to get some more information. But just Googling generally insect conservation and ways to help insects, and you'll come up with a lot of information.
Well, thank you so much, David, for your interview today. You had a lot of great information, and I look forward to reading your book, hopefully.